Hi, this is Maureen Milliken.
And this is Rebecca Milliken, and this is Groovy Tube.
The Crimes of the Brady Bunch. I keep saying this every episode, but we're roaring in.
Yeah, almost done.
Round in third and heading for home. Today's episode is a rare Cindy plot, and I'll talk about the rareness of that later. And we'll talk a lot more about Susan Olsen and Cindy after we go through the show, too.
Yes, and this is our...
Yeah, this is our 31st episode.
Yeah, we are on season 5, episode 20.
Whoa.
Of the Brady Bunch series. Yeah, and it is the Snooper star. And it's no surprise that Cindy's the star with that name.
Right, because most of her plots revolve around her. And this is the second diary, Marcia diary plot.
Oh,
remember
yeah.
the Desi Arnaz one?
Yeah.
And I just want to say, too, before you start, there's good old-fashioned Brady trickery.
Yes, there is.
And very mean-spirited.
Oh, yes, it is. I think it is, too.
And this was written by Harry Winkler, who is not related to Henry Winkler, although Henry Winkler's father was named Harry. But this was the fourth episode he wrote. He also wrote Sergeant Emma, The Show Must Go On, and The Elopement. So I would say this is one of his less good efforts.
And, you know, I can't help but think, especially after watching that documentary about Nickelodeon recently.
Right.
Quiet on the Set. Women would make so much better writers.
I know. And they're so much cheaper.
For children's shows, too. Yeah, I know.
And you can pay two one sailor.
Yeah, two for one. Okay. So the first scene, you know, they show the Brady house. And then we're in the driveway and Peter is tinkering with a bike. And Bobby comes out through the glassless slider door. And Bobby says he needs the $2 Peter owes him. And Peter says he'll pay him next week. And Bobby says, that's what he said last week. And Peter says, that's because, and this names to me, and because there's no closed captions, I couldn't tell, sounded like the person's name was Marsh Nell, but it doesn't really matter, but I couldn't figure out the name.
I know. And then I'm like, did he mean Marsha?
No, I think it's a guy. I think
right,
it's a friend of his.
Right.
So he says that's because his friend, of what name we don't know,
right,
didn't pay him back. And Peter says, come on, we're relatives. And Bobby says, it isn't his fault, they're relatives. Then Cindy approaches. She asks if they were talking about her, and they're like, no.
Because they said the word relative,
yeah,
which is a reach.
And she's like, well, why did you stop talking when I came over? What were you talking about? And Peter says, if we wanted you to know, we wouldn't have stopped talking. Duh.
Mm-hmm.
And Cindy looks sad and walks towards the house, and Bobby and Peter just shrug at each other.
And I want to point out, before we plunge into this plot, I think that this whole thing is poorly written and
yes,
that her motivation
yes,
is not well developed. And again, I know it's not Shakespeare. I know it's not Ibsen or something, but it doesn't even make sense what
no,
she's asking. And then the upcoming scenes, they do
yes,
not make sense.
Yes.
It does not make sense. Even if she were six, it wouldn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. We're in the family room now. Greg is at the pass-through. He's on the phone with Maxie, I think her name is. Mm-hmm. And he says, he'll be there. That's wild. And he says, I should never expect that. And Cindy is behind him. She's lurking behind him. She's looking at the magazines and stuff. And Greg tells Maxie to hold on. And he covers the receiver and says, do you need something? And Cindy's like, no. And Greg says, well, this is a private conversation. And Cindy's like, about me?
Which, and again, does not
yes,
make
Cindy,
sense.
Yes, Cindy, it's obviously about you.
She's
Greg's
going
to be talking to some chick about his younger sister.
She's obviously suffering some severe mental illness that's
like narcissism or paranoia. It's like maybe she was smoking pot.
And
she's
also,
paranoid.
Aside from Cindy's newly emerged paranoia, if Greg wants to have a private telephone conversation, I know the options in that house aren't great, but don't sit in the fucking pass-through between the family room and the kitchen, the two most used rooms in the house, and not expect one of your five siblings to be around.
That's true. Greg laughs and says, no, it's not about you. And Cindy's like, then why can't I listen? And Greg says, I told you, it's personal. And Cindy says, maybe I'm the person it's personal about. It's like, how old are you, girl? And Greg tells her to get the fuck out. He has no patience.
And I know we will talk about this at the end, but I do want to say in his book, Growing Up Brady, Barry Williams, he has a synopsis of each episode. And before the synopsis of this one, he has a quote from Susan Olson saying, I remember thinking, gee, this would have been a good script if we'd done it 4 years ago.
Yeah. So, and you'll see. Yes.
Right. But it's not a good script because her whole motivation here, thinking everything's about her, they could have led into what the ultimate thing is some other way.
Yes. Now we're in the girls' room. Marcia's sitting at the desk writing. The hippo dog thing is on the wall behind her.
Yeah, I looked at it closely.
Cindy comes up and looks over Marcia's shoulder, and Marcia snaps the book shut. Cindy asks Marcia if she was writing about her in her diary. Marcia says, no. Cindy says, then why'd you slam it shut? And Marcia says, because it's personal. Cindy says, if it isn't about me, can I look? And Marcia says, no. And Cindy says, someday when she gets a diary, Marcia can look. And Marcia's like, fuck off, Cindy. And Cindy goes to leave, and Marcia starts to put the diary in the desk drawer. But then, like, right as the scene's ending, she seems to have second thoughts and she starts to, like, take it out. Like, they cut the scene there. It looks like she's, like, almost taking it out again as Cindy leaves.
Right. And I wondered if there was just, like, a scene continuity issue there. The plot kind of got ahead of what was going on or something.
Now, we're in the boys' room. Cindy comes in. Oliver is on the top bunk reading a magazine. Cindy asks him if he knows something about her that she doesn't know. And he says, not that I know of. And why is the 8-year-old more mature than the 12-year-old? I want to know.
Because he's male.
And I noticed this. And then when I was listening to, I listened to the Brady Brothers this afternoon after I had already done my notes and stuff. Chris Knight notices too. They show Oliver, Cindy's talking to him. He's up on the bunk. And then they show Cindy, like, from Oliver's point of view, but behind her should be the other bed and stuff, but it's like wallpaper. It's not like the right wall. It's really weird.
No, that is weird. I didn't notice that.
And Chris Knight mentioned it.
Oh, wow.
He and I are of the same.
Yeah. Point.
Cindy says something funny is going on and she's going to find out what it is. She asks Oliver for his help doing detective work. He's excited. She says there'll be private eyes. And Oliver says, I'll be good at that. He has 4 eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it would have made much more sense if there were things that really led her to believe people were talking about her.
Right.
When none of the things really were that way. Like if Greg were saying something that made it sound like if he said, oh, yeah, she's got blonde curl.
Right.
You know,
I know, because this just is like totally. Like,
she's like making it up in her mind like she's a narcissist. Like
if it were really happening, it would be a sign of severe mental illness.
Yes.
Because
and I actually have something to talk about that later.
Okay.
I had a thought when I was watching this. Now we're in Mike and Carol's room. Mike is wearing a pink plaid shirt and trying to choose between 2 ties, one with pink and black and other color stripes, and the other with geometric shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And he's wearing this plaid shirt. So it's quite
I thought
pink.
It was a striped shirt, pink and white horizontal
stripes.
No, it's stripes.
Plaid. Carol comes in wearing a blue velour like house dress. So it must be morning. And Carol says she likes the geometric tie. It's her favorite. And Mike says he's not sure it's right for today. And Carol wants to know what's so special about today. And Mike says he's meeting a new client.
Mm.
And Carol says, is he a tie freak?
Mm-hmm.
And Mike says, it's a she.
Mm-hmm.
And Carol wants to know what she's like. And Mike says, picture the face of Elizabeth Taylor, the body of Raquel Welch, and the bank account of Queen Elizabeth.
Mm.
And Carol says, too bad she's a loser. Mike laughs about Carol being jealous.
And she isn't even really acting jealous.
I know.
It's like he's just assuming because she's a woman. And he's meeting a woman.
I probably would have said something like that, too. Oh, she sounds like a real loser. Ha ha.
Exactly. She was joking because he makes her sound like a combination of Elizabeth Taylor, Raquel Welch, and Queen Elizabeth.
I know.
You know?
But then she says she was planning on spending the day at his office.
And then she tries to strangle him.
Yeah, she tries to strangle him with his tie.
And that was cute.
He assures her that although his client is rich, she does not resemble Liz or Raquel. But maybe kind of Queen Elizabeth.
So Carol doesn't have to worry because Mike would only cheat on her with an attractive shape.
Well, what about BB? Remember?
I was going to bring BB up, but later when Lovey comes on.
Cindy and Oliver come in. Cindy wants to know if something is going on. You know, is something going on in this family? And Carol and Mike say nothing they know of. Mike says one thing they should know is it's time for school and they're late, and he kicks them out. They have one of those dumb conversations that I just...
Yeah, those wordplay conversations that really aren't that clever. Like, oh,
Jesus.
And I also wanted to point out that nobody seems very concerned that the two youngest kids in the family have not left for school.
Mike is kind of... Mike is the only one...
Right, but then nobody does anything about it.
I know.
And nobody... Yeah. When are they going to go to school? And isn't anyone going to make sure they get there?
Well, you know how it was back in the 70s.
I know.
Just let your even kindergartner just walk to school by yourself. The only one that got lost was poor Jimmy.
Yeah, that doesn't
sound... I was supposed to walk with Billy, but he wouldn't let me walk with him. Mm. Walked with his friend. I wasn't allowed to. Mm. I had to walk by myself. In the hall, Cindy tells Oliver to stand guard while she reads Marcia's diary to see if Marcia wrote about her. Seriously, she's becoming delusional.
She
a
is.
Teenage girl is going to write about her younger sister. The only thing I would write about my younger sister is like, my younger sister is being a little bitch and she better not be reading this diary or I'll fucking kick her ass.
Yeah.
Cindy tells Oliver to whistle if someone is coming. Cindy goes in the room and takes Marcia's diary out of the desk and starts reading. Alice comes down the hall with laundry. Oliver tries to whistle, but hardly any sound is coming out. Mm-hmm. And Alice is like, what are you trying to do? And he's like, I'm trying to whistle. So Alice tries to show him how to by blowing, like, which I can't do.
Right.
And she can't do it, but she does that one through her teeth where you go, wee, wee. I can't do that either. But you know that how loud whistle.
Right.
Cindy immediately comes out. Alice says she'll teach Oliver after school if he wants to learn how to whistle. And he says, no, thanks. And Alex looks annoyed and leaves. Cindy says Marcia didn't mention her once in the diary. All she found was a dumb poem.
Mm.
And Oliver says, well, he learned that he can't whistle. Now they show the exterior of Mike's office, which, as we talked about, was a library.
Right. With the cool books. Yeah.
Yes, with books on it. Mrs. Howell is looking at plans.
The actress Natalie Schaefer.
Lovey.
Yeah, I can't say. You can say it. I can't.
She tells Mike that she usually only deals with Mr. Matthews, the company president. So I guess Mr. Phillips is not the big boss.
I have a note about that. There are apparently two episodes this season where Mike's boss is referred to as Mr. Matthews. And there's no explanation about it. And Lloyd Schwartz was later asked about it. And he said, well, Mr. Matthews is Mr. Phillips' boss. But he's never been mentioned before. They don't really clarify it here. Not that it... I think Lloyd was just covering his ass.
Yeah, that could be.
And although, also, the president of an architectural firm isn't the one who's going to be doing the plans for somebody.
I know, that's true.
And I also want to say, too, you know, we mentioned B.B. Gallini from episode one a few minutes ago. Why are the only two women that Mike has to deal with on his job in these five seasons crazy, eccentric women who seem to want unreasonable things?
That's what all women are like.
Yeah. Well, it's just another aspect of the misogyny
will tell you,
in a misogynistic episode.
This scene actually kind of triggered me, I have to say.
Oh.
I'm not an architect, but I am. Some of you might know I'm a kitchen designer, and I have dealt with people like this, but guess what? They're usually not women.
No, they're boomer men.
Yeah. And don't come after me talking about boomers, because I think
I'm a boomer.
Gen X. Yeah.
You're technically Gen X, but you're right on the line.
Yeah.
Because it's 1964.
I'm an old Gen X.
And you're 1965. And I'm a young boomer because I'm 1961 and it's 1964.
Anyways, I have dealt with people like this, mm-hmm. and it's a pain in the ass. Although, this is another thing I'll say before I go on. I have found that women designers and probably women architects don't have the issue that we have here, because Mike is saying, he's saying he did what she asked for, but did he? Because I found that I listen to what people want, and I normally do not have this kind of conversation that we're going to talk about, because I have actually listened to them and I have put what they want in the design, not what I think that they want. I put what they tell me
what they want.
So I'm just saying, when women are the designer or probably architect, so we don't know her name yet, but I called her Mrs. Howell. She says she's only dealing with Mike because Mr. Matthews recommended him. And also he's out of town. And Mike is kissing her ass big time. And
he's totally emasculated in this scene.
Yes, but still presumptuous.
Yes.
Mike says he's sure this is just what she wants for the Penelope Fletcher Cultural Center. She says it is not what she wants. And Mike says it was to her specifications. And she says she doesn't care about specifications. And Mike says he can show her the notes. And she says she doesn't care about notes. She just wants the building to be a monument to her. Well, she says a monument to the benefactor, which we have
find out is her, right?
She is Penelope Fletcher. Mike is flummoxed. She says she's leaving town Thursday and he better have a suitable design for her by then or she'll take her business elsewhere. And as I said, he probably didn't have, I mean, maybe I'm just, you know, projecting. It's making her look bad, but maybe he didn't give her what she asked for.
That could very well be.
He didn't give Bibi Galini the powder puff he did not. She wanted.
He did not, because whenever he has to do something for a woman, the woman's crazy and unreasonable and emasculates him.
What are you going to do, these
what's
women?
What's he going to do?
Girl's room. Marcia is talking to Jan and has her diary in her hand. She says the bookmark is in the wrong place and the diary was not under her phone book where she normally puts it. Jan says, do you really think someone is snooping? Marcia says, yes. And the person who's snooping sleeps in this room. Jan says, hey, I sleep in this room.
The clothes, the dresses both Cindy and Jan wear in this episode are like something out of a early 1960s children. I mean, I was not dressing that way.
Some girls did wear
time.
Dresses like that, though.
I don't know. They just seemed like formal party dress kind of thing.
Well, yeah, so, but Marcia says, I don't mean you. I'm always reading it to you. Jan says, true, but you can't just accuse Cindy of snooping without proof.
Why not?
I know. Marcia says she'll get proof. She'll use a little bait and trap her, and both of them laugh.
I feel like Jan is getting into this because for once she's not the crazy person.
That's true.
And like she's on board with going after the crazy person.
Yeah.
Big time.
Yeah, you got to. So yeah. It takes the focus off you. They hear Cindy coming because she says something to Oliver. And Jan says, get the cheese ready. Here comes the mouse.
Mm-hmm.
Jan and Marcia start ooing and eyeing over the diary. When Cindy comes in, they quickly close the book.
And can I say, in Cindy's defense, earlier when she has to see Marcia's diary, Marcia's like, no way. What is she? But Marcia's obviously sharing her diary with Jan. So I wouldn't blame Cindy for being a little put off by that.
The thing that's dumb about this plot, if you are a younger sibling and are reading your older sibling's diary, it's to find out juicy stuff. It's not to see if they're talking about you.
No.
Marcia puts it in the desk drawer and tells Cindy that they're going to the library. As soon as they leave, Cindy immediately opens the drawer.
Mm-hmm.
In the boys' room, Jan and Marcia come in and say they need the bathroom. Peter is at the desk and yells, hey, you have a door on your side. And they tell him it's stuck. Bobby's lying on the bed and says, no, I know why hermits want to be hermits. Marcia and Jan slowly open the bathroom door that goes, you know, into the girls' room and peek at Cindy, who for some reason does not, she has her back to them, but still, come on.
Right. The layout of the room, actually, if it were accurate, they would be in her peripheral vision, and she would be facing like the bathroom door would be to her right.
Yes, that's how I picture it too.
Peripheral vision.
That's how Cindy is perusing the diary. Marcia looks vindicated and Jan looks pissed, which is interesting. And then they close the door slowly. Jan wants to confront Cindy.
Jan is like, let's
you're not a Brady, Jan. Marcia has another idea. You wouldn't just confront somebody. You gotta trick them. Marcia tells Jan she's gonna teach Cindy a lesson and she's gonna write something that will drive Cindy bananas. That makes the girls giddy and they run through the boys' room again, prompting Peter to ask if it's a freeway. And Jan tells them that she and Marcia couldn't bear to be away from you beautiful people. After they leave, Peter gets up and lodges a chair under the doorknob. In the kitchen, Carol is cooking something.
She's adding an awful lot of whatever's in that.
Some kind of spice. Yeah. She's shaking a bottle of it. Mike comes in and says he's never met a more aggravating woman in his life. And Mike says he'd like to call that Penelope Fletcher and tell her to. And Carol cuts him off and says, Mike, what if you blow the account? And Mike says he won't. He won't call her, but he'd like. Carol says, try reverse psychology, which actually don't see how that would work.
Yeah.
Mark Twain said to make friends of your enemies and it will drive them crazy.
This is anecdotal, but I've read in at least two places. Mark Twain is the person who the most quotes he never said is attributed to.
I thought the same thing when she said that.
I know.
Although I agree with her advice, although it's not really reverse psychology.
No,
I agree that if I have to deal with difficult people, I kill them with kindness. It's the only way to deal with it. And not to drive them crazy. Because just too stupid to realize what you're doing.
Right. And also you're just going to compound the problem on the job, not in life.
Not in life when you're working.
Right.
It depends on your job, but Mike said Mark Twain never met Penelope. He tells Carol Penelope will gain a friend and Carol will lose a husband because he'll have to work night and day to get her the design she wants. Carol looks kind of upset. I can't figure out the word, not annoyed or upset, but just kind of like, And then we're in the girls' room. Cindy is reading Marcia's diary. Marcia's voiceover says something fantastic might be happening for Cindy. She told everyone, including Alice, and swore them to secrecy. Cindy is elated. She opens the door to the hall where Oliver is waiting. Cindy tells Oliver something great is going to happen. She doesn't know what it is, but the whole family knows. So she and Oliver are going to cross-examine them, but they have to do it without anyone suspecting. Alice comes by and asks if they're having a secret conference. The kids ask Alice if she knows any secrets about something fantastic happening. Alice says, yes, her goldfish is expecting babies. Or she said, one of my goldfish is an expectant mother. I don't know anything about fish, but don't they like lay eggs?
Yeah.
But do they get like...
No.
Oliver says, what's so fantastic about that? And Alice says, the fish is named Herman.
Gender bending on the Brady Bunch. Oliver decades.
Laughs. I know. And actually, decades Oliver before. Laughs, but it's like a fake laugh.
Right. Yeah, he's funny.
And then he asks Cindy if she has any other brilliant ideas after Alice leaves. And she says, yes, she takes him into the linen closet. Meanwhile, Alice is bringing shirts up to Greg's room. And if we remember the linen closet from the goat one?
The goat one, right.
In the linen closet, Cindy says they can hear everything in Greg's room through the vent. You think Greg would have remedied this situation?
Speaking of the goat, I just realized, because the goat's name was Raquel, that this episode had one of the, I think I read it in one of the books, like 18 Raquel Welch references over the course of the 5 seasons, and this episode earlier was one of them when Mike said she had body. So that was one of their obsessions.
So she says we can hear everything, and Oliver is like, well, is that right?
He's not a Brady.
Shinzi says, sure, if they're talking about me. Seriously, she has a severe case of narcissism.
She's got something, whether it's narcissism or
mental health,
some kind of paranoia that came on suddenly, and they need to get her to a doctor right away instead of making it worse by playing tricks on her.
So now we're in Greg's room. He's lying on his bed, like just lying there like a corpse. Alice is putting away his shirts. And she had socks because she told Oliver and Cindy she had shirts and socks. Alice says, he looks like he has a problem. And Greg says, what would you do if you had 2 dates for 1 night?
He already should know what he would do because this problem has come
up. He has to find someone that looks just like him.
Or like get Peter to put on a mustache. I mean, there are many solutions because it's come up before. He should have learned that by now.
Alice said if she had 2 dates, she'd faint. Like, aha, make fun of ugly Alice. Greg says he doesn't want either girl to get hurt. And Alice says, why not tell them the truth? And Greg says, why tell a girl the truth?
Yeah.
Oh, it's so funny. Isn't misogyny funny? Alice throws his socks up in the air and it falls on him. In exasperation, she leaves. In the linen closet, Cindy and Oliver get down from they're up on a step stool that was conveniently in there so people can go listen to Greg.
I know, through the vent.
Cindy can't believe they weren't talking about her. Oliver says TV detectives never had it this hard. Cindy wonders if they can get something out of Peter and Bobby. In the backyard, Bobby and Peter are on their bikes. And Peter gives Bobby a quarter as a down payment on the $2 he owes him so he'll stop bugging him. And I have a side note here. When Bobby talks about the $2 Peter owes him, I don't know if you ever saw the movie Better Off Dead with John Cusack.
Yes, I did.
There's a thing through the whole movie where the paperboy is pursuing him saying, I want my $2. I want my $2. Like, right. No matter where he goes. And people from our generation that saw this movie, I think it was one of the movies that was, it seemed like it was on HBO a million times. Right. So we always used to joke about that. And it seems like people our age are a little, like maybe a few years younger than me. Like if you say, I want my $2.
Right. They know what you're talking about. Right.
That's what I thought of. So back to the show. So they have this argument and Bobby and Peter ride off. And we see Cindy and Oliver hiding under a fence. Gee, they didn't mention Cindy in their conversation. She's very disappointed by that. We're probably about halfway through the show. I'm already sick of this plot point. It's so stupid.
I was sick of it even before, just because it's another example.
It's so impossible.
It's just another example of an idea that they never made any attempt to flesh out or make realistic in any way. And I know it's a TV sitcom. It's not going to be quote unquote realistic, but it doesn't even scan.
I know.
You know, her reactions and what she wants doesn't,
that's why
it doesn't
make
sense.
I think it's a brain tumor. Oliver wants to know their next move. Cindy says they'll have to check Marcia's diary tomorrow. In the girls' room, Marcia is writing in her diary with a sly look on her face. She laughs at what she's writing. Jan comes in. Marcia tells Jan she has an idea that's going to drive Cindy, quote, absolutely ape. Jan says that's the next step. She's already bananas.
And again, Jan, so gratified that for once, she's not an insane person. That now there's somebody crazier than she is, and she's relishing it.
Yeah. Cindy apparently loves Shirley Temple. Marcia and Jan discuss how, you know, Cindy, remember how she always watched those movies and she loved her and blah, blah, blah. Marcia says, wait until Cindy reads this. And then they switch the scene to Cindy at a later time reading, and they have Marcia's voiceover. Marcia writes that some talent scout loved the photo of Cindy Marcia sent, and Cindy might be the new Shirley Temple they're looking for. And I have another note. Shirley Temple started her career at age 3. She reached her peak at age 6. She stepped back. Well, she's kind of slowed down by the time she was 10 and stepped back completely at age 12 and went to school.
And right, this was in the 1930s. Right?
And she started in the 30s and went into the 40s. She returned to acting a little bit in her late teens, early 20s. Then she retired at 22. She didn't like acting anymore. But her peak time was age six. Cindy is fucking 12.
Yes.
She's too fucking old to be the new Shirley Temple.
Yes.
And if she was to be the new Shirley Temple, it would be a very short-lived Shirley Temple, because no one wants to see a fucking 12-year-old acting cutesy.
And we'll discuss that whole concept a little more after. But I also want to say, and it never is really addressed in this episode, this is a really cruel trick. I know the Bradys are about trickery and teaching lessons instead of just saying, Cindy, stay the fuck out of my diary.
Yeah.
Or else I'm going to bash your fucking little head or whatever the hell we... But this is cruel. And there are things Marcia could have written in there that weren't cruel. Like, Cindy, I know you're reading this.
Yes.
Stop it. But of course, there wouldn't be a plot unless the writers had more imagination and creativity and thought of a plot around that somehow. But this is just cruel. Marcia's a fucking psychopath.
I know. And Jan is too. But we already knew Jan was.
Right.
Cindy is totally thrilled. Jan and Marcia are spying through the bathroom door, amused. Cindy looks at herself in the mirror, which they always do, and says, Cindy Brady, the new Shirley Temple, which causes Marcia and Jan to crack up. They close the door and they're in, I can't think of the word, but they are just laughing.
Paroxysms.
Yes, Jan says she's hooked. And Marcia says, wait until she reads the next entry. And they both laugh. And they cut to Cindy smiling at herself in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I thought it was very cruel. And it was insane to laugh about. The next day in the girls' room, Cindy and Oliver enter. Cindy sends Oliver out to the hall to watch, and she retrieves the diary. Marcia's latest entry says the talent scout is really interested. They're going to have someone visit the house anonymously to check Cindy out. And Marcia hopes Cindy will sing and dance like Shirley Temple. Cindy is thrilled. She opens the door and tells Oliver the news. Oliver is weirdly excited. The poor kid has no life.
Because he has nothing. He has no life.
And Cindy says she needs to get a Shirley Temple record album. They always say record album.
Yeah.
They don't say record or they don't say album.
Right.
We used to call them albums.
Records.
Or records.
Albums.
Yeah.
I think we call them records at that
age.
But then when we started getting cool and getting the ones that you could open and they had all the liner notes and stuff.
But also like you could call a 45 a record too.
Right.
Like all the old people that are listening to us know what we're talking about.
The first, in fact.
I don't think young people listen to us.
The first 45 I ever bought with my own money was at Bettman's Pharmacy in Kettering, Ohio, which, you know, used to be on the way to and from school when we went to
school. I remember that. I didn't remember
the name. For 39 cents. And it was Carly Simon, Anticipation.
Oh, Carly.
We
were
just
talking
about
it today.
Carly today. And the first album I ever bought was with Liz. I think we also bought that at Bettman's because they had records there. And Even though it had been out for years, we pooled our money and bought Rubber Soul, the Beatles.
Oh, well, that's a good one. Cindy says she needs to start being Shirley Temple right away. In the kitchen, Alice is cooking. Cindy is asking Alice for money because mom and dad aren't home. And it's urgent. And it's like, really? You're asking the employee for money? Mm-hmm. Isn't that a little, I don't know.
Yeah.
Oliver says Cindy is going to be rich and famous, so she'll pay Alice mm-hmm. back. Alice is like, how? And Cindy says, Alice, you don't have to pretend anymore. And Alice is like, what? And Oliver says, what, you're pretending? And Alice is like, what? And the convo is just one of those annoying ones again that I'm not going to go through.
I know. Ugh, boring.
Alice says, how much do you need? And Cindy says, well, how much is a record by you know who? And Alice says, is that a new group? Actually, that wouldn't be a bad name.
No.
Oliver says she's pretending again, and Alice gets annoyed and gives Cindy the money. She's probably as annoyed as I was by the
Yeah, Alice is like, just give me the change. I don't know what she gives her, a 20 or something. Just give me the change.
Probably a $5 bill.
Yeah.
In the girls' room, Jan comes in and tells Marcia about Cindy borrowing money for a record by you know who. Shirley Temple, Marcia shrieks. And Greg comes in to get a book back that Marcia borrowed. And the girls are laughing uproariously. Greg wants to know why. And they tell him Cindy thinks she's going to be the next Shirley Temple. And Greg is confused.
Yeah. And I expected more. I expected
I did too.
I expected Greg to either say, oh, that's a great trick, or Greg to say, what the fuck are you guys doing?
I know.
But I expected him to have some reaction.
They didn't. That was weird. It's like, what was the point of him
even
coming
in? Why have Greg
in
the scene, right?
I know. Just to get him more in the show, maybe, or something?
I guess.
Now, we're in the family room, and Mike is stressed. He tells Carol that Penelope wants the plans tonight, and she's dropping by the house to pick them up on the way to the airport. And then he says she traded in her broom for a plane. Ha 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 ha. Because she's such a witch.
Right.
That's the implication.
I get it. Women, what are you going
to
do?
It's supposed to be funny. In the backyard, Peter and Bobby are playing football. Oliver and Cindy walk towards the house, and Cindy's holding a paper bag. Peter and Bobby ask Cindy, what's in the bag? She says, a record album. What kind? Bob and Pete ask. The round kind, Cindy says, and Oliver says, with the hole in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Oliver's become Cindy's sidekick.
Lapdog.
Instead of Bobby. So the boys want to see it, and Cindy says, you know what it is. And Oliver says, they better be nice to Cindy because she's going to be rich and famous, and he's going to help.
Mm.
And Peter says, what are you gonna do, rip off a bank? And Bobby laughs and says, yeah, Bonnie and Clyde.
Mm-hmm.
And Cindy says, very funny. And she and Oliver go through the glassless slider. The boys are funny when they're making fun of people.
Yeah, they are.
In the girls' room, Cindy holds up the album with a very young looking Shirley Temple's face on it and asks Oliver if he sees a resemblance. He says, well, you're both girls. Cindy says if she curled her hair like Shirley, they'd look a lot more alike. Then she says she better learn the songs. And I feel like if she was really a huge Shirley Temple fan, she'd know
the songs.
Alice comes in and says dinner will be late because Mike has an important client coming and you better be on your best behavior.
Mm.
And after she leaves, Cindy jumps to the conclusion that the client is the talent scout, as we knew.
Because who else would it be? Right.
Yeah. Because of her brain tumor, everything mm-hmm, is
right.
So she has a record player in there, which I didn't notice at first. She puts the record on the record player and Cindy says, tonight a star is born.
Mm.
And Oliver is very excited by this whole thing. Poor kid.
Mm-hmm.
Later in the girls' room, Marcia and Jan come in and ask Cindy if she wants to go to the library. Cindy says she's not giving up her career for a walk to the library. Marcia's like, what are you talking about? And Cindy says, you don't have to pretend anymore. She confesses that she snooped in Marcia's diary and knows all about the talent scout coming tonight. And Marcia's like, well, I have a confession to make. I made that up. And the Marcia and Jan are alarmed. They
what
should be.
The fuck did they expect?
I know.
What was the end game here? What did they think the outcome was going to be?
I know. Marcia says, Cindy, I made all that up to teach you a lesson. And Jan says, yes, she did. She really did. And Cindy just does not believe them.
No. And why should she?
Marcia reiterates, it was a put on. I made that up to teach you a lesson. And she says, do you understand? And Cindy says, yes, I understand. And Marcia and Jan look at each other concerned, but then they leave. But before they leave, Marcia says, now don't do anything.
They could have stopped things right there instead of going to the library. They could have said, Cindy, we're going to stay here with you.
I know.
We're going to be here like two orderlies in an insane yes. asylum or something, and not let this happen. Not let whatever's going to happen happen. Or go down and tell mom and dad or somebody, look, yes. somebody thinks this person coming. Because not only, as we see, not only is it going to be a humiliation for Cindy, it could wicked mess up. Mike could yes. end up unemployed.
Yes. Now, as soon as they leave, Cindy runs in the bathroom and starts putting curlers in her hair.
Mm-hmm.
She says, get ready, Shirley. And I went to Mike and Carol's bedroom. Mike comes from their, I guess it's they have a bathroom back there. I'm assuming that
yeah,
they have
do.
Their own bathroom.
Because they have a massive
although we never see
bedroom.
It. And of course, no one's allowed to use it, even if when someone's
and,
has
and
to
can
really
I
go
just
to the bathroom.
Talk, I wanted to mention when Cindy was curling her hair too, that there's a timeline issue. Dinner's going to be late because this person's coming over. So you assume it's like late afternoon at least, right? It's getting close to dinner time. And Cindy's going to curl her hair.
And learn all those
and learn
routines.
All the songs.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't make whatever. Sense.
I was thinking that, especially doing her hair like that.
Those
that takes
curls,
hours.
Right. Not that the men writing the script.
No, they don't. That's what I thought too. I'm like, oh God, that would have taken you. And then I thought, oh, right. they don't know. They're yeah. men. So Mike comes in. He's see his hairy chest. He's buttoning up his shirt. Carol is writing something at her desk. Carol tells him not to get upset if Penelope is unpleasant. And he says, if she's sour, I'll ignore her. If she's disagreeable, I'll smile. If she's insulting, I'll laugh. Then I'll throw her out of the house.
Mm.
Like, yeah, Mike, throw
yeah,
your job
big
away.
Big man.
Dumbass. Now we're in the living room. The doorbell rings. Alice goes to answer the door, and it's Penelope.
And Alice is very obsequious and servant-like.
Well, that's her job.
And that's true.
She says, oh, yeah, but she kind of gives her a little stick. She's like, oh, they weren't expecting you this early.
Right.
So Penelope is there. Is there anything she can get her? And Penelope says, yes, Mr. Brady, I'm in a hurry. And Alice is like, jeez.
If it was a man who said that, it'd be fine.
Yeah, I know.
Because he's a big man. He's got important things to do.
Exactly. And it's true. Alice goes, well, let me go get Mr. and Mrs. Brady. It's like, why does fucking Carol have to be there?
To protect Mike.
Penelope, she starts looking around the room and she picks up a family portrait and she counts to six and she's like, six. And then she like rolls her eyes.
I know. I thought that was funny. Lovey.
I will say that. I like, what's her name?
Natalie Schaefer.
Oh, Natalie Schaefer. Yeah, I thought she did a good job.
It's always funny. It's not really anymore, but in the 60s and 70s, how women, matronly women who were supposed to be wealthy, talked in these Englishy type accents. Yeah. And you almost wonder, did really wealthy Americans used to have English?
They did have a different way of talking, though. Like if you watch old news things and stuff yeah. with people talking. So Penelope's down there in the living room. Cindy comes out at the top of the stairs, and I really dread vicarious embarrassment.
I don't even know if I watched this. I must have watched this episode at the time. And actually, Susan Olsen and I are the same age. And it's mm-hmm. funny because I always think of her as younger.
Yeah.
But this is not only the biggest humiliation of Cindy's life.
Yes.
But also, I think of Susan Olsen, and I give her 100% yes. credit for pulling off this scene when she must have been just dying inside.
And I have a couple.
And
things
we have a lot
later.
To talk about.
Yeah, we'll
right.
talk about it later. Cindy sees Penelope and comes down the stairs, and Penelope says, "Who are you?" Or "Who are you?" You know. And Cindy says, "I'm the one you came to see." And Penelope says, "You're the one I came to see." And I kind of like the way she acts. Penelope
right.
acts towards right. her. It's kind of interesting. She doesn't give a fuck. Penelope. Right. She's just like, huh. Cindy tells her, she's like, "Stop pretending. You're anonymous." And Penelope's like, "Whatever."
Right.
And then Cindy launches into a not very good. If she really thinks she's going to be the next
Shirley Temple. Not very good. Good ship lollipop. And
good ship lollipop.
And I actually wondered if she were doing, if Susan Olsen was deliberately maybe
doing
at the direction
bad.
Of the director
yes.
doing it poorly, because she is not a bad singer or dancer.
No.
I mean, the Cindy's been taking ballet.
I know.
For years. So it seems like she could pull this dance off, even though it's not ballet. But yeah.
But and her singing isn't.
It's awful.
Penelope just has that same resting bitch face look on her face.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see Mike and Carol come to the top of the stairs with looks of horror on their
pure
face.
Pure horror.
I want to talk about that later, too.
Okay.
But now, you know, we hear Cindy singing when we see Mike and Carol, but we don't see what's going on down in the living room. And then they pan down to the living room and we see that Penelope is now dancing and singing with Cindy. And Carol looks very confused.
And she should
come downstairs. Mike breaks in to introduce Carol. And Carol's like, Cindy, what the fuck are you doing? Cindy says, this is my big chance. And Penelope says, this child is under the impression that I'm a talent scout. And Penelope is entranced by Cindy's portrayal.
Yeah.
And the memories of Shirley Temple, who she adored. And I think that actually she's probably about the right age to have grown up with Shirley Temple.
Yeah, she was
mom remembers her.
Right. She's a little older. She was born, I looked her up, and I want to say she was born in like 1915, 1918 or something like that. So she would have been older than Shirley Temple. And
she thanks Cindy for a wonderful evening. She like kisses her on the top of her head. She gives her a little kind of an embrace from behind. Like she hugs her
The only person, by the way, who's shown Cindy any kind of affection or positive affirmation in this entire
stranger.
Episode.
She's like, oh, I've got to leave. I've got a plane to catch. And Mike's like, here's your plans. I'm sure they're what you want. And Penelope says, yeah. She's like, oh, yeah, they don't matter anyway. Whatever.
Some of the books that synopsize this say that Cindy won the day. Now Penelope's fine with the plans. And I felt it was ambiguous. That was what it was supposed to be. But I'm like, is she not going to proceed with the plans?
I think she's going to proceed. I think she just doesn't really, she never really gave a shit about the plans. I mean, she was probably fine with them before. She just wanted.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
I think she just, because she is such an unhappy person, she's a ball buster because that's what women do.
Right.
And now Cindy has somehow softened her heart.
Okay.
Mike looks annoyed when she says, yeah, that's fine. It doesn't matter. Penelope starts singing Good Ship Lollipop and dances out the door. Carol says to Cindy, young lady, there better be a good explanation. And Cindy says, that's what I was just thinking.
Yeah.
Now later, we're in the family room. Yeah, lecture time.
And I'm disappointed on two levels. A, all we get is the very tail end of the lecture. So we don't get
like
a classic
short lecture.
And B, Cindy is the one getting lectured for snooping.
Hey, she's been told for years. Oh, no, that was the tattletale thing. Okay, never mind.
Same difference, right? Snooping, tattletaling, having a secret.
So it's Carol and Mike and the three girls. Mike says, just because it ended okay doesn't make snooping right. And Cindy says, she learned her lesson. She won't snoop anymore. And Marcia and Jan say, they're done with trickery, which I seriously doubt. Although they are, because we don't see
them. And I'm like, wow. So Cindy is somehow the bad guy here.
Yeah.
When this cruel joke they played.
Oh, I know. It was horrible.
Humiliating this poor child, making her believe something really good was going to happen. It's just very mean, very cruel. And they almost messed up Mike's deal. But yet Cindy's, for some reason, somehow, because snooping is bad. Snooping is bad. But
well, if she hadn't snooped, she wouldn't have done all that.
Right.
It's all her fault. Yeah. Like, if she hadn't dressed that way, she wouldn't get raped. I mean, you know,
exactly.
And Carol says, let's keep it that way. After the girls leave, Carol turns to Mike and he says, she hopes he learned his lesson too. And Mike's like, what? Carol says, next time you have to deal with Penelope Fletcher, do your Shirley Temple impersonation. And then they both start singing Good Ship Lollipop.
Yeah.
Here's the tag, the family room. Cindy comes in and greets Marcia, who is sitting at the table doing some whatever. Cindy has a present for Marcia and it's a diary. Marcia opens it. Marcia says, I already have one. And it's like, even if you do, Marcia, you're going to fill it up and need another one.
Right.
It's a diary, but whatever.
Right. No,
that's
shit.
Not the point. Not with the lock on it, says Cindy. Marcia says, but you said you wouldn't snoop anymore. And Cindy says, but it's a girl's privilege to change her mind, and I might. And they both laugh. First of all, the saying, although I don't agree with it, is it's a woman's prerogative to change her mind, not privilege.
Right.
But also, if Cindy says, and I might, that means Cindy did not learn her lesson about snooping.
And we do have a lot to say, but before we get into all the Susan Olsen stuff, I just want to say about Oliver again, and I know I'm a broken record on this, but it was the same situation as with Bobby in the last episode, where instead of him getting a plot, it's not even like he's a foil for Cindy. He's just there following her around and affirming. They could have had the exact same plot and almost same script without him. And again, if you're going to get this kid in order to refresh the show and everything, give him something to do. He needs a plot and needs something to do instead of just being there. We know they were half-hearted about him, and Lloyd and Sherwood were not really on board with bringing the poor kid in. I think he's the most talented child actor on the show.
He went on to do a lot of stuff after that.
Yeah,
and Lloyd tells us.
Yes, Lloyd discovered him. But he served the same purpose here that he did with Bobby the last episode, just following Cindy around, being there for her to talk to, you know, as an exposition
tool.
He's obviously funny and cute and talented. It's like they didn't know what to do with him.
And like I told you, I texted you while I was watching, he is one of the better. I mean, for his age, he's really the best actor for his age. Greg was always a good actor, but he started when he was 14.
I think Bobby, Mike Lickenland was.
Yeah, he was good too.
Pretty good. So we do have a lot to say about Susan Olsen and Cindy, especially since there are only 2 more episodes, and she's not prominent in either one of them. And so I want to say what Lloyd Schwartz and Sherwood Schwartz say about Susan Olsen. And what Susan Olsen told Barry Williams. And as we know, as we talked about in previous episodes over the years, Susan Olsen was very bright, very smart, like the opposite of Cindy.
I know.
And I think, too, before I get into that, the men who wrote and created the show didn't know what to do with the girls. They knew what to do with the boys. And Lloyd even said a lot of this is based on stuff that happened in childhood. Well, the boys are given more plots, bigger plots. And the last 2 seasons, solo plots and then plots like 1 or 2 kids shared but had prominent parts. In season 4, Greg had 5, Marcia 4, Peter 4, Jan 3, Bobby 6. And Cindy, too, one of those which was shared with Bobby, and that was that quiz show one, and that was more of a Bobby thing. In season 5, and I didn't go back the earlier ones, in season 5, Greg had 6, Marcia had 5, Jan had 3, Bobby had 6, and Cindy had 2. This one, the Snow White one.
Mm.
And the Snow White one's actually the only one she got to kind of act like a person in. And as we talked about, the Schwartzes claim that the kids pretty much got to act their personalities.
Mm.
But I feel like the boys did.
The boys did.
And I feel like the girls, maybe Maureen McCormick did.
Yes.
A little bit. But Jan was boxed, Eve Plum boxed, because Lloyd didn't like her, into this insane manic. And she, aside from Susan Olsen, got the fewest amount of plots. And Susan Olsen, as we'll talk more extensively about, was forever the 6-year-old kid.
Yes.
She couldn't, they would not let her grow up.
And so I think that Maureen was their favorite, the guy's favorite, from the time she was a little girl.
They liked her quite a bit. So here's what Sherwood says about when he interviewed the kids for their roles. The one interview that does stand out in my mind was Susan Olsen's. She came in and started describing a recent role she had on Gunsmoke. That's how she said it. And yes, the lisp was real. She told me about how she got to ride on a horse, that there was a snake. She was adorable. And she got to be Cindy based on that brief meeting. And he puts Cindy with a lisp there. Later, I heard that people thought that I forced her lisp. With Susan, as with all the kids, we just took who they were and they became their characters. Lloyd says, when he talks about the kids being hired, and as the cute little blonde girl, Susan Olsen, Cindy was the most unlike the character she portrayed. The lisp was real, but there was and is far more to Susan than the dialogue she said as Cindy. Susan at 6 was more like a peer of Maureen or Eve. I nicknamed her the Suze. I thought it would give her more substance and reflect on her determination. Asking, where's the Suze, gives somebody more weight than asking, where's Susie? And I feel like, I think he's trying to make it sound like he was kind of an advocate for her and recognized her, when he obviously didn't, because if you believe all the stuff he said about himself in that book, he had a tremendous amount of influence on the scripts and how the kids were acted. And, you know, Susan Olsen was never really allowed to grow up, or like, look at the difference between Maureen McCormick when she was 12.
Yeah.
In the first season or whatever. And here's what Susan Olsen told Barry Williams, and I'm going to read from his book. Some of this may sound familiar if you've listened to some really old episodes. Barry Williams said, Most of us Brady kids didn't have to stretch too far in bringing to life our Brady alter egos. That's because Sherwood Schwartz thought it would be more natural to have us more or less be ourselves on screen rather than superficial, stereotypical, or one-dimensional characters. There was, however, one glaring exception. Cindy. Susan Olsen is almost nothing like Cindy. In fact, she is more her opposite, the anti-Cindy, perhaps even an evil twin. I asked Susan about it, and here's what she said. Susan said, I thought Cindy was the single biggest geek in the world. She was an idiot, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
She was an idiot. I mean, I didn't like Cindy, but I really hated the fact she was stupid. Even as a kid in the first season, I can remember running up to my mom and asking her, why is it funny and cute to be stupid? Why is Cindy stupid? And why is that a good thing? If you ever stop and listen to some of the lines that come out of Cindy's mouth, you come away with the idea that she's retarded. And that's Susan Olsen's word. I remember the worst one came during the first season and that episode where we all had the measles. Carol comes into Cindy's room and gives her a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And Cindy asks, how come you always give me peanut butter and jelly? And Carol says, because they're your favorite. To which moron Cindy replies, oh yeah, I keep forgetting.
Ugh.
I can remember even then being really distressed about it and asking my mother, why? Why do I have to say this stuff? And what made it worse is that I have to go back to school after this and try to live down what Cindy did. Let's face it, kids are horrible psychotic maniacs and just plain cruel a lot of the time, so it can be really tough. I remember going to school the Monday after the Tattletale episode, and no one would talk to me. I'd be like, come on, you know that wasn't me. You know I don't squeal. You know that I can keep a secret. But in the world of schoolyard justice, being a tattletale is about as low as you can possibly sink, and I hated catching shit for what Cindy the Geek did. In another place, Greg is talking about the director Oscar Rudolph, who directed a lot of the episodes, particularly early on in the series. And he was kind of a dominating person, and they had a lot of issues with him. But Barry Williams says, the degree to which each of us kids was objectified ran in reverse order of age. I was the oldest, and I was patronized, but I never came close to experiencing what the younger kids did, what the younger kids had to put up with. Susan Olsen told me about it. She said, I really resented being treated as an object, and most of the adults that worked with us respected us as people who were doing a job and being professional, and they were good with us. But some people refused to acknowledge the fact the kids could be communicated with. You know, they'd be surprised when other crew members would speak to us in the same manner they'd speak to an adult. But when I was at work, I was a worker. I didn't want to be talked down to. I didn't want to be treated with less respect than anybody else. What Oscar would do if he wanted me to move somewhere on the set, instead of saying, okay, Susie, can you take three steps left or whatever, he'd just pick me up and move me.
Ugh.
I can still remember his thumbs in my armpits. Even then, I remember thinking, he doesn't do that to Florence. One time, when he didn't like the shirt that wardrobe had put me in, he started taking my shirt off, just exactly like I was a mannequin or something. You know, we've talked a lot about Lloyd's misremembering things, but also his explanation about the show in the series. It was created by grown men, run by grown men. The boy stuff, they seem to like the boys better by the amount of plots.
They get better lines.
Greg and Bobby, they get better lines. They are not treated as negatively in scripts. And the biggest thing with Susan Olsen is she was not allowed to grow up. And I don't think it's because, oh, we need a little kid on the show. I think they didn't recognize her as a human being who could grow up. And I can't remember, I thought it was in one of these books, but her lisp, I don't think it was nearly as pronounced. I thought I read somewhere, maybe it was Maury McCormick's book, that it wasn't, and it went away fairly soon, but they still kept making
She said in the, I just recently.
Yeah, why don't you talk about what they said on.
I listened to that this afternoon, Christopher Knight and Barry Williams podcast, The Real Brady Bros. They have an episode from December of 22 about this episode, the Snooper Star. First of all, Barry said that he didn't know if he had seen it since it was on. He doesn't remember, but he rewatched it, obviously. And he said that he felt so bad for Susan Olsen having to do that role. and so did Chris. And they also said that they also acknowledged that the boys had a lot better storylines than the girls in this show. They talked about it was Barry, who's usually more
boomer man.
Said, you know, the boys always had better, funner things to do. And the girls, they just didn't do stuff. And then Barry also said at that last scene, the second to last scene where Mike and Carol come down the stairs and Florence has like this really angry look on her face. Barry thought that he said Florence was very protective of the kids on the show. And he felt that Florence, and he may have talked to her about it at some point, that she was very upset about the scene, about the plot, and how kind of humiliating it was for Susan and for the character of Cindy. Because it really is.
It is. It's
not age appropriate at all. And both of them, it's funny because they mentioned a lot of the things that we mentioned, how she seems narcissistic and paranoid for no reason.
Right.
And she's too old to be a Shirley Temple, to want to be someone that age. Does
like,
not
couldn't
want
they
to
have
Shirley
even
Temple.
Picked out somebody else for her to be?
I know. I was trying to think of who was a.
Or not even.
Like, even Judy Garland, you know, from Wizard of Oz. At least she was the same age.
But I think part of it is because the men running the show and writing the scripts, that's the only little girl they could think of.
And like Greg said, Barry said, and like we were just saying, they never let her grow up. She wasn't allowed to have decent plots.
And like I was saying, I don't think it was them saying, we need a child. Because Bobby was allowed to...
Yeah, it was because she's a girl.
Older. Yeah.
She was a subjectified little girl because even when they're little girls, they're objectified. Oh, but what I was going to say about the lisp is I was listening to another one. It was the episode, The Tattletale, and Susan Olsen was a guest. And she said that she did get rid of the lisp later with... She had a speech therapy and stuff because they were joking about it. They said, oh, did you do tongue twisters? And she said, no, those never helped. She gradually did get rid of it. But
they still made her... I don't know where I read it.
I mean, like, she doesn't really have it that much in the later ones as much when she was little. But she hated Cindy. She hated the character Cindy. And I'd love to know what she thought about this one. But just judging by, you know, Barry Williams especially was like, just watching it was really hard for me. I think he almost had an epiphany watching this episode about how differently the girl characters were treated.
Right. This episode wasn't even fair to Marcia and Jan.
No.
Because it was out of character for Marcia to do something that cruel.
For them to think it was funny and not to realize how horrible it is.
Right.
And like, and the ending of it was like, okay, Cindy was mistaken and she was tricked, but she doesn't seem too crushed. I mean, she had built it up. And then suddenly that's, it's not true. And so
it was
she's
poorly
okay.
Written. Right.
I know. It would be really cool idea to have like a show, not that I could write it, but where you took the plots, but they were really like detailed and serious. So like the character Cindy actually had something seriously wrong with her. Like if you would take the same plot, but you would write it in a logical, serious way, how it would come.
Although Mike and Carol are so clueless that they don't notice that their child has a serious mental illness.
I know.
Just the casual misogyny of Natalie Schaefer's character, because you can't have a woman, a businesswoman, and it reminded me of was Bebe Galini and how silly she was in a different way, but you can't have a serious female businesswoman who's rich and wants a thing built. She has to be silly. And the way the girls behaved, even the minor scenes with the boys had the richer, more realistically drawn dialogue and actions in their little scenes than what the girls had in this. And just the amount of plots that Susan Olsen in the last two seasons got, two plots each season, one shared with Bobby in the fourth season, the quiz one, then Greg is getting six, Bobby's getting six. I don't think they even recognized it. You know, I really don't think they saw the girls as equal partners, equal people.
Well, they're not as interesting, apparently, unless they're being objectified. I mean, that part of that is the, you know, the times.
Yeah, I
mean,
know.
That's what women were treated like then.
And all Cindy's plots, like the first season or two, she was a little kid, and there were a lot more group plots, like the one where the kids got sick or whatever. But just like Eve Plum, the few plots they get that focus on them, they're very negative. It's about their negative behavior. Yeah. And I'm not saying there aren't ones where the boys don't have negative behavior and stuff, but they're given more opportunities to have more nuanced behavior, yeah, more interesting plots. Where
Eve is always crazy, and Cindy's either
Cindy's doing something that's bothering people, doing something that causes problems for somebody, you know, and it's too bad. But this one, just the lack of a decent storyline, they could have done it so much differently.
I know.
If they wanted, and they probably don't even think this way, but if they wanted a story where Mike had this difficult client and it was going to culminate in one of the kids doing something that could have been disastrous but actually won the client over, with Cindy as the person driving that plot, there's so many things they could have done.
Yeah, I agree. Know?
And again, not to beat this too much, but Oliver, what was the point of even adding that kid to the show?
I know. He hasn't done any.
Like I said, they didn't know what to do with him.
See, if it was nowadays, it could have been Oliver that idolized Shirley Temple, and he could have
done it. Oh, and I wanted to mention, I read somewhere in one of these books, Susan Olsen said, I felt more like Jodie Foster. And Jodie Foster, and she and Susan Olsen are basically the same age. And she's like, and she was getting all these roles, usually the tomboy, tough kid roles. And Susan Olsen's like, that's the kind of stuff I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I remember last episode, I can't remember what you said about Jodie Foster. Was it last episode or was it on?
No, it was on our other podcast because I was talking about the True Detective show.
Right. Oh, right. But so
crime and stuff.
One of my first memories of Jodie Foster, and I was born in 1961. She was born in 1962. So we're close to the same age. When I was a little kid and just like being aware of the TV shows I was watching and stuff, she was all over TV.
Yes.
And I remember her being on The Courtship of Eddie's Father. So I looked her up and yeah, she was on like every show, The Courtship of Eddie's Father, Adam 12, Gunsmoke.
Yeah.
In fact, she and Susan Olsen were both on episodes of Julia.
Oh, yeah.
The show with Diane Carroll.
Yeah.
The first show about a black woman professional. We used to watch that with that cute little boy.
Yes.
In fact, Harry Winkler wrote that show. The guy who wrote this episode was like Julia's head writer.
Huh.
It's kind of mind-blowing. And both Susan Olsen and Jodie Foster were on Julia, each on several episodes, which is kind of funny. So Harry Winkler could write a show like Julia and then write this episode. But again, you don't know how much influence. Lloyd makes it sound like the scripts were pretty much his ideas. I don't know what the writers did. I thought I read in his book somewhere how it all worked, but I couldn't find it. So our next, the second to the last show, The Hustler, where, if I remember correctly, Mike gets a gift of a pool table and Bobby kind of becomes a pool hustler.
Ooh, well, that's an interesting one.
And then the final one after that will be the harebrained scheme, the one where Robert Reed melted down and it ended up being the last show. We'll be talking a lot about that one because Lloyd, of course, has a lot to say. Barry Williams has a lot to say. We won't read the whole thing, but the memo Robert wrote about
Robert.
The script.
Yeah. So, yes. So,
until next time.
Stay groovy.